Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start off with Ask the Secretary of Education. Matt Malone joins us to discuss snow, funding, MCAS, and more. Then he'll take your calls. Then Globe editor Brian McGrory on the Sochi Olympics, the Times' decision to print Dylan Farrow's Woody Allen eviscerating letter, and priorities at Brandeis University.
Just days after the drug overdose death of famed actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us on the painkiller epidemic leading some to heroin addiction. Then, the tobacco crackdown continues. CVS nationwide will stop selling cigarettes, and teens are targeted in new anti-smoking ads. Plus, we'll meet the just-announced independent candidate for Massachusetts governor, Jeff McCormick. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Snowpocalypse, Marjorie. I want to beat you to the punch. Yeah, I know. It's okay. In any case, we're thrilled the Secretary of Education, Matt Malone, apparently is an essential state employee. Otherwise, he may not have made it to GBH today. He's here with us in the studio to take our questions and yours at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Secretary Malone, good to see you.
Hello, Secretary.
It's great to be here on this wonderful New England day.
Well, you know, before we get into the education issues that you're here to talk about, you've already become a legend in your own time because apparently you have an extraordinary pair of boots that you wore in here this morning.
What's up with that?
Do you have any details on those boots? Should we go out and buy some for ourselves? Or what's the deal?
Yeah, I bought these boots up in Vermont. They're Sorel boots. Jim would look small in these boots. I could walk from here to Alaska right now in these boots. I mean, people make fun of me for my boots all the time, but, you know, I am proud of these boots, and they allowed me to be here today to be
good
with you and our listening audience.
They have, like, tire treads in the bottom or something.
They are like a rocket ship of bootness. They are the warmest, most protective boots in the world.
Secretary Malone, one of the things we were talking about when the schools were closed a week or so ago, when they probably, shouldn't have been, when the snow didn't live up to expectations, unlike today, you were a superintendent of places like Brockton, I think Swampscott and some other places before you became Secretary of Education. Marjorie and I were talking about, it wasn't so long ago that the system was you wake up at dawn as a parent and you either go online, or if it was pre-online, you call the phone number, find out. The new trend in places, well, like Boston, virtually everywhere, is you find out the night before if schools are closed. Sometimes it was a right call, sometimes not such a right call. What's your take on this? And is it all about childcare? Is that what it's about?
It's funny to ask me this question. I have a reputation for not calling snow days. Mm-hmm. I believe in having school. I mean, parents have to work. If we call a snow day and parents have to go to work, now we have kids at home with no parents. Or parents have to take the day off, and that's a day of pay.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that.
I really think, and I believe, and, you know, people can argue with me, it's in some cases, it's safer to keep schools open. Now, granted, a day like today, That was a dangerous day. That was a commute storm. We had to call school today. But I do believe in the old school method of getting up at 4:30 and walking outside and seeing how much snow's there. I mean, this is very hard for parents. Now, let me rephrase this for a second or restate my point. I'm a parent of two children. My wife works, and our kids go to the Boston Public Schools. So I hear it not only from professionals, but also from other parents sometimes when school is called early or perhaps when it's called and it should have been called. I don't know if you guys remember last winter, there was a storm in Boston, and I think people overslept, and we went to work, and life proceeded. There was about 8 inches of snow out there, and everyone went to school. Sometimes we call a little bit early. I don't like calling for less than 8 inches unless it's a real bad rush hour storm.
Well, you said some people may disagree with you. One person who disagrees with you is a guy who did a study, I can't think of his name, out of the Kennedy School at Harvard about a week or two ago. It came out and said, actually, he didn't comment on you, but you're wrong, that it is far better to close school. And he wasn't focusing on the issues you were focusing on, parents and childcare and that sort of thing, and leaving the kid at home. It's far better to close school so that every kid has the same experience that day, which is none, essentially, as opposed to keeping it open when, let's say, 20, 30, 40% of the kids get there, the other 60%, 50%, whatever, miss that day's thing. What's your response to him?
Look, I think because the way that schools have decentralized and we've gone to a system of universal design where we can push kids deeper into content knowledge and differentiate instruction, I think that the excuse of, well, we have to be on the same page on the same date at the same time doesn't hold any water for me personally and professionally. I would suggest that perhaps we could still engage in very active learning experiences for kids when they are in school.
That's the voice of Secretary Matt Maloney, Secretary of Education for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. He's here to take your calls and our questions. If you want to talk to Secretary Malone directly, you can do it at 877-301-8970. You know, ordinarily, Marty, we don't invite high school calls. We get an occasional one when a kid is home. But if there's a high school student who's got a question for Secretary Malone, it can't be about getting out of a test or something like that. But if it's something that has broader application, feel free to call the Secretary at 877-301-8970.
And I also wanted to ask you, because I'm fascinated by this whole possibility that there may be a replacing of the MCAS with a different kind of test, PARCC test.
But PARC.
Before we even get to the PARC test, what's the bottom line on the MCAS test? They were very controversial. Lots of people didn't like them. I noticed from my oldest kid to my youngest kid that once the MCAS came, my younger children learned a lot more grammar and a lot more math than my older kid did because they had to pass it on the test. But a lot of people think that they're terrible.
I support the whole standard-based movement. I know nothing else professionally, having come into education in 1993 when the Ed Reform Act was passed. I graduated from a system that didn't have standards, and quite frankly, there's things I graduated that I wasn't held accountable for that I wish I knew now.
Me too.
So that is a real issue. I like the standards-based. The MCAS is an assessment, assesses a set of standards. I think it does a good job of assessing those standards. However, what we're finding is it's not a good predictor for actually college and career success. So what we're doing right now is field testing a new assessment, the PARC, and that assessment is designed around the Common Core standards, which are as equally as rigorous as the Massachusetts frameworks. It's a whole other debate that we have. What I like about them is it's really focused on nonfiction and textual evidence, and it allows us to be much more interdisciplinary. But the new PARC assessment will assess whether or not students are college and career ready. The Board of Education has voted to field test it. We're going down this road this spring, and we're going to look at the results and do some action research as we learn. And then in a couple of years, the board will have a conversation about whether or not we change assessment systems.
You hear this all the time, we have to teach to the test argument. What's been your rejoinder to that?
Well, I think some folks that just say that are just say it because they're angry about some personal issue in their lives. I personally think that when you have a set of standards, you assess them. I also think that you can still do the arts and humanities and in-depth sciences and a whole host of interdisciplinary project-based learning activities that make school exciting and fun. Why do we go to school? Because we want to be enriched. We want to have fun. We want to engage. We want to change the world. You can still do that with the Common Core standards. I get frustrated with some folks who keep writing editorials about, you know, the end of the world is coming and, oh, my God, I can't look in the mirror at myself anymore. And I always say, look, let's have fun with what's happening in schools. I'm in schools 3 days a week. The practices that I see are engaging. They're rich and students are having fun learning. And this is the best time ever to be a student in Massachusetts public schools.
I want to ask one more question about standardized testing. But before I do, I know you make a ton of visits, Secretary Malone. Are these surprise visits in any cases? You schedule with superintendents, principals, that sort of thing?
So what we do is we schedule. Sometimes it's a day ahead if something breaks and we have some free time to get out in schools. But our visits are really about getting out and engaging local systems and the governor's message and reforms and work that we're doing to support closing achievement gaps.
You know, one of the things I knew nothing about, Kirk Carapeza is our higher ed reporter at WGBH. He was talking to me and Marjorie this morning about something about which I knew nothing that I'm actually quite interested in. We talk a lot about higher ed, the affordability, the state, whatever. He mentions that the president in his State of the Union the other day said, quote, to give it's his goal to give parents more information and colleges more incentives to offer better value. And he says, in the past, faculty members have opposed at higher ed standardized testing. And he says, Massachusetts, this is what I didn't know, is now developing something that takes a different approach by scoring samples of college student work. What's the genesis of that? How's it going? What do you hope to get out of it? What's happening?
So this stems from the work of the Vision Project to look at not issues of affordability, but really issues of quality across our state college campuses and universities. It's exciting concept since it's brand new. We don't have any data yet to talk about, but I'm excited and encouraged about what the data will produce to continue.
How does it work? I mean, give us an example. What does it mean sampling a student's work? What do you do? What would how does it work?
My understanding is a sampling of student results from an assessment in a common course across various campuses to look at the norm. What's the central composition of looking at a random sample of assessment results and saying, well, here are the clear patterns that Massachusetts students are doing well in, and here are some things that each campus needs to work on. I think the issue of demystifying, though, tuition and fees is something that we're taking on, or we're taking on in the Higher Education Finance Reform Commission that the governor is established.
You know,
this year.
We talked to the governor when he was here. I think it was last week. I'm not sure about his budget had been released, but he hadn't given the state of the state yet. And we talked about the state of finances and public higher education. We were talking about private fees, private tuition the other day, which is beyond obscene. And I know that your goal last year, you achieved your goal this year, is to put enough additional money in higher ed so that there's no increase in, I think it's tuition and fees, but at least one of those things. But the bottom line is, even though a far better financial deal public higher education is than private schools for the most part, it's still out of the reach of so many people. Does anybody have a, including your boss, does anybody have a real fix for these tuitions that leave these kids and their parents in colossal debt and often lead them to choose a field of work other than that which you'd like to see them go into because they can't make enough money to pay off their debt?
So, our governor gets this from a deep personal level, and no one is more committed to making college more affordable than our governor. He wants to increase access and opportunity to close gaps, not just achievement gaps, but true opportunity and economic gaps in our Commonwealth, and that's what he's committed to through this model. It's fixing a system, a financial system that it has not been transparent, that when we look at fixed costs versus increased rising costs, when we look at the juxtaposition between the tuition and the fees and trying to find the right balance, whether the money stays on campuses or is controlled centrally, these issues are issues that we're struggling with legislatively through this higher ed finance task force, and we'll hope to have a report released at the end of the spring that will be taken up, and we can make some increased reforms and or continued reforms as we did at community college.
Just one last thing about this, and Marjorie, I know, wants to move to something, but. We were discussing with Charlie Baker yesterday, a proposal your Deval Patrick made before you were the Secretary of Education, didn't go anywhere, free community colleges, so essentially as training grounds for people for the jobs that are there but aren't getting filled. As a philosophical point, Matt Malone, if everybody in this country, with very few exceptions, accepts the notion that school should be free through 12th grade, and that notion was created at a time when high school education is what you needed to, at a minimum, to prosper. And now that everybody knows, well, not everybody, now that most people think that a college education is critical for most young people, is anybody discussing the notion that higher education should be free? I know there's a big financial nut to crack, but what's the argument that it shouldn't be treated just like public K through 12?
Well, I don't think there's an argument against it. It's just a question of nothing is free. There's a cost. And, you know, K through 12, we pay taxes.
It's, right. I understand. But so why shouldn't taxpayers fund that as well?
Right now, we do fund higher ed. We offset a certain portion of the tuition. What we're looking at now is, but what is the right balance to get to the right machinations, if you will, of like a Chapter 70 formula that we use at K-12 for higher ed. That hasn't been existed, but we're talking about these things right now. This is really complicated work, and the good news is that we're talking about it, and we got some of the best and brightest folks thinking about ways that we can fix this. I don't think it's going to be fixed overnight. However, I think we're going to get a beachhead that the next administration will be able to take forward, and our governor is going to be responsible for that.
We're talking with Secretary of Education Matt Malone. We're going to continue our conversation up next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she's Marjorie Egan.
We're talking with Secretary of Education Matt Malone. Our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to call with your education questions. 877-301-8970. I had a couple of emails I wanted to get to. One is not going forward. It's going backwards. Maybe this person has a personality problem. I don't know, Secretary. But she's a teacher in the third grade in Boston, and she wants to know what the desired effect is of all the standardized tests in public education, because she says her third graders take 20 standardized tests a year, which means 20 full days of mislearning, and kids in ESL and special ed and so forth miss it. 20 a year? That sounds awful high.
I don't disagree with the level of frustration in the field. I mean, we have to get this right. We don't have it right yet. We're working on getting it right, and we don't want to be assessment nation, but we need to have a balance of good formative and summative assessments that give us reliable data that we can then use to differentiate and focus on each child as an individual learner. I think the folks in the field, and I hear this every visit I go to, are feeling a little bit overwhelmed. I think there is some fear of accountability, and I've been just telling folks, and this is the only way I know how to lead, folks, let's work together, let's collaborate, let's take a deep breath, and let's focus on the good work we're doing.
And by the way, MCAS are taken over in chunks over periods of days, right? It's not just you do one MCAS for one day and you're done. It's several days, right?
It's a battery of assessments across a window.
You know, let's say on third grade, no, but just for one second, because I read something. Charlie Chippio, I assume you know Charlie. Charlie's an occasional guest in the studio here, wrote something after the governor's state of the state and said, while it is true, and I'm paraphrasing, while it is true that we have the highest test scores in the country in the standardized tests, he goes on to write in an op-ed that he put somewhere, after several years of stagnation, the percentage of third graders, in the state, who scored proficient or advanced on MCAS reading tests fell to its lowest level since 2009 at 57%. The portion of third graders reading at or above the proficient level is 10 points lower than it was in 2002. One, is that true? And two, that's pretty troubling if it is true, isn't it?
So third and fourth grade results have been flat or decreased in some areas across the last several years. That is the truth. And we're focused on investing in early childhood to turn around that trend. We're focused on investing in increased English language learner training for adults and students in the classrooms. We'll reverse that. And we're also looking at more wraparound service, extending time to get at the whole child, if you will. This is, you know, we're educating challenging to educate population more frequently, not just in our inner cities, but in exurbia as our urban areas spread. And our folks in the field are up to the task. I disagree with one point that gentleman, who I don't know, made in his article about SAT scores declining. It's true that they're declining, but we're also assessing more students on the SAT that never would even thought about their ability to go to college in the past. So when you assess a larger pool of people, of course, the results, it used to be the elite only are taking the SAT. Yeah. Now it's, hey, everyone's going to college. You know, this is the new normal. So folks that perhaps aren't great test takers, like the Secretary of Education, are now taking the SAT, and it's going to drop the scores a little bit. But guess what? We're putting more kids into college, and overall, our 10th grade results are the highest they've ever been. So, you know, his article was a little misleading, and I'm a glass half full type of person.
We're talking with Secretary of Education Matt Malone, 877-301-8970. Secretary, you just mentioned early childhood education, and I always thought that the younger you could get kids into school, the better. Give them a head start and stuff. And then I got criticized by Charlie Baker, actually, who's running for governor, who said, well, actually, when you look at with the studies, you find out that kids kind of even out in second or third grade. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what he claims. But I also thought the big push for early childhood education was to get kids out of challenging and tough environments in tough neighborhoods where there's a lot of poverty and get them into schools, kind of more like a head start kind of thing with teaching.
I mean, early childhood education care is to really get folks engaged in learning activities, learn literacy and numeracy, social skills at a young age. It gets them an equal playing field for when they enter compulsory education at 6 years old. I think that, you know, there's been multiple studies about whether Head Start works on third grade achievement results as opposed to those kids who had it and those kids who didn't have it. I think the data is a mixed bag, and you can make any argument you want. But here's what we know. We know that when we engage, especially second language learners, in English literacy instruction at 4 and 5 year olds, we know that their likelihood of increasing achievement results and proficiency up through a lifetime of learning, not just the 3rd and 4th grade results, are real. You know, Charlie, his former selectman in Swampscott, where I was a superintendent, Charlie and I know each other well.
Oh, I forgot that. You know, were you a superintendent? Yeah. How was he as a selectman?
He's tall as you.
He is. How is he as a – whoa, forget this education thing. How is he as a selectman, a guy who wants to be governor, former superintendent Malone?
Charlie Baker's a good man. I mean, I've worked closely with him. I know his kids and his family. They went to the Swampscott Public Schools, and he definitely understands the value of a free public education, and also understands the need to invest in doing things right. He'll probably differ opinion on some of the cost savings efficiencies here or there. But you know, this guy is not a guy that sent his kids to private school and walked away. I mean, he invested in the town of Swampscott, and his kids are great kids.
But I interrupted you when you were about to comment on the whole divide between Marjorie's view and what she expressed to be Charlie's view.
No, I mean, our governor's view is clearly that if we invest in early childhood, we'll increase a student's likelihood to close achievement gaps and opportunity gaps. We also know that we have 30,000 students on wait lists, and we got to reduce that. We have an inequity in this state where those who can do and those don't have the financial means aren't getting it. And quite frankly, that's not fair.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Before we get back,
I'm getting emails telling me that there's a problem with the phones, that people are calling and they're not getting through.
So. Well, I'm sorry. We're not into phone callers. It's a thing. I have a personal problem that I'm trying to vent on. We're going to try to fix the phone lines in a second. You know, before we get back to education for a minute, we mentioned this the first time we met you. One of our great colleagues, Abby, was a student at Duxbury Middle School when you were the assistant principal there.
Yeah.
And trash is your enemy, homework is your friend, was your motto, correct?
It still is.
Have you seen Mitt, the movie on Netflix? Have you seen it?
No, but do I need to see it?
Well, actually, there's a scene that Marjorie and I have been borderline obsessed with in which he walks around. She thinks it's his deck. I think it's his living room. And he's picking up little pieces of trash off the floor. And literally, I thought of you when I said, because of that great, what was the genesis of that, Matt Malone?
So when I was hired to be the assistant principal of Duxbury Middle School, I was coming out of Burke High School. And they wanted someone.
Jeremiah Burke High School.
Yeah, I was a teacher at the Burke.
Yeah.
And they wanted someone to come in there and get order and discipline. And one of the things I noticed was the school was dirty. So I started a campaign. Trash is our enemy. Homework is our friend. We chanted it. We said it every morning over the microphone. We got on buses and we ran around the fields chanting it. And we cleaned the school. It was kind of like the whole the theory in New York City. The
broken windows. Right.
Giuliani.
Right.
Yeah.
Before that was even written in the literature. So I think that what was great about middle school kids overall, this is a 5 through 8 schools, they rally around. So we had trash is our enemy. Homework is our friend. Then we had another slogan: see it, pick it up, throw it out. And we would chant that. And then we had a lot of fun just, you know, being middle school kids with a goofy assistant principal. But guess what? We got discipline and we got order and we had a lot of fun. And I get a lot of emails and calls from folks who I had as students and their parents. And I miss them. And that was a great experience.
Okay, could you please chant, see it, pick it up, throw it out for us, please?
It's see it, pick it up, throw it out.
See it, pick it up, throw it out.
I like it.
Again.
You know, we have another great email about something that we get asked, well, not Jim and me, but people that are experts like you, Secretary Malone, get asked a lot about in education, talking about, we have a lot of violence in this country, domestic violence, child violence, bullying, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the emailer wants to know if you support nonviolence education in our schools to teach kids how to live harmoniously in society and make us all safer. There is some, isn't there?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, open court, the PBIS model that we're doing around behavioral science and work, support we're doing around trauma recovery. I mean, this is all work about trying to teach empathy and fellowship. I mean, it's you know, how do we reduce bullying by focusing on nonviolence and getting along with each other? I mean, this is core. I mean, and let's just
so
be
it
frank.
Is there.
It is there. But also, this is all, you know, when we pick shared reading texts, when we pick novels to read, and they have these themes, that's how you get at the core concepts. I mean, that's where you build values. I think in our schools, because we allow for academic freedom, adults to pick the the works that they want to use within the standards, of course, but the frameworks. I visited a class yesterday where they're reading Diary of Anne Frank, and what are they talking about when you visit the classroom? And those are the kind of values that we get at. This was a middle school class in, where was I yesterday? Mansfield.
So what's your deal? Do you just kind of pop by?
No, I got an entourage. And it's funny. We like to go under the radar, but I invite the local delegation. We invite the union president, the superintendent, school committee, and then whoever the elected officials are that local and statewide who come and in the media, and we have a blast, and we're seeing amazing stuff. And if you follow, please go check us out on Flickr. See our Flickr page. We've documented our journey over the last 13 months. And in my office, in my office, there is a map that has every single town and city of Massachusetts. And we have a pin in every single community we've done a visit on. Our governor believes in governing for the entire Commonwealth. And I have taken that to heart. And I am out there every single day, rain, sleet, or snow, checking folks out and learning. And then bringing back what we're learning to the board level to help change policy.
That's the voice of Matt Maloney, the Secretary of Education for the Commonwealth. Mr. Secretary, several weeks ago, the governor formed this commission on school safety. What's the deal? I understand what the goal is, but I guess a couple of things. One, why now? And particularly, why not 13 months ago, right after Sandy Hook? And two, what's the mission? What are you supposed to be accomplishing here and by when?
So the mission here is for us to work across secretariats, develop a set of tools that local systems can use in the toolbox of planning their emergency planning plans. And we're hopeful to have some concepts of a model plan in place, some recommendations on best practices, some case studies, because all these issues right now are local issues and various places use different techniques and procedures. So we're going to try to find what are the best procedures, what are the best strategy and tactics to use, and then provide them with some resources. This is an issue that I don't want folks to think our governor has not been focused on. When he interviewed me, this is one of the things that he and I talked about and shared the idea, but let's get this cross-secretariat task force off the ground. We did. And we're going to have a report in June. We'll have it hopefully in the site level's hands in the middle of the summer that they can use for opening of school next year.
Well, this whole issue of, obviously the number one job beyond educating the kid in as broad a fashion as you can is obviously keeping him or her safe. But when I was a city councilor, I occasionally visited a school too. And, the difference between the environment, as well-intended as people are, when you can just walk into a school, I don't mean just walk in without signing in, obviously, yeah. If you're an adult. You walk into a school, or the next level is you walk in and there's a security guard, or the third level is you walk in and there's an armed security guard. When you're the kid, I don't have any data to back me up. As a human, I say to myself, it creates a totally different learning environment when the kid walks past those people, even if it becomes sort of part of the woodwork. That is part of the consideration. While keeping them safe, you don't want them to think they're walking into an armed camp, right? I mean, isn't that a huge part of the consideration?
It's balancing that. It's interesting. So in some places, it's like you have kids that come up to you and thank you for having. When I was in Boston, though, the metal detectors, which I don't necessarily believe in. But that is an example of one end of how we enter buildings. Another one is it's just open doors. But, if we're doing metal detectors and checking bags and I'm pulling out knives and other things.
In the high schools.
And taking them away. Yeah. And then the kids come and thank you. I feel safer here today now because of what you. So it's a balance. We don't want kids to feel that they're in armed camps. However, we don't want kids to feel unsafe
ever. Of course.
So try to find that blend. Look. I look at this issue the same way as I look at most issues in life. The best possible decisions will be made by the people on the ground through collaboration and working out common sense. And I think that this task force will be highly effective in being able to deliver on a set of tools. And we have over, I think we have it right now, 100 or 80 what we're calling expert advisors who will be basically giving testimony to the task force of 25 members of the governor's executive order. But this outside group of SROs, parents, school police officers, trauma experts, principals, teachers, you know, everyone kind of having a say in what is the best way to ensure that we have safe and secure schools.
You know, what's the, you've been doing, how long have you been doing this? A year and a half? How long have you been doing this?
13 months.
Okay. What's, I have seen you in action. I ordinarily wouldn't do this with you here, but since I was, my kid was in the city year for a year. You spoke at the graduation. I should say, I told you this, Marjorie.
Yes, you did.
A ton of the city year kids in advance were going, oh my God, secretary. I mean, like, we want to hear this. It was, I'm not kidding, and I've said this to your face, Mem, one of the best speeches the kids I've ever heard in my whole life. So I know what the best part of the job is. I mean, I know it's contact with the kids. You really connect in a way that is really admirable. What's the worst part? What's the most frustrating? What's the worst part of the job for someone who's spent his whole life in and around kids and schools and that sort of thing? What's the toughest part, hardest part?
The hardest part is, for me personally, is probably... the policy stuff, the highest level stuff that has, we talk about it way up here, but the interaction is down here. I'm an interaction kind of guy, but the reason why I don't necessarily hate the policy stuff is that now I have an opportunity to affect it before, you know, I'm down in the field saying, whoever the hell thought of this crazy policy that we're now implementing? So, you know, the work to me is in the field. It is that interaction. It's engaging with folks. It's learning from doing, which I love. The hardest part, and it's not hard. I mean, hard is the work that's happening in the field every day. You know, this job I have now is it's hard in terms of it's a lot of hours and, you know, but I don't look at any part of it as something that is so hard I dislike it. I mean, you know, the things that, you know, we're up at 4:30 this morning making a decision on the state of snow emergency. I mean, those kinds of things, you know, you look at it, you say, I like that the least because I hate getting up at 4:30, you know, that kind of thing. But it's, how great is it to be a part of making a decision with our governor that he values my opinion when he asked me at 4:30, what do you think about schools today? You know, so I love this job, but I tell you the best part. I mean, I know we'll run out of time.
That's okay.
The best part of this job is an example of... Thursday morning, I'm at Haley House in Roxbury. You know, I'm there meeting with Mel King. And Mel and I, we talk. We talk big picture stuff. But we also talk small ground level stuff around work that we're trying to...
Mel King, for the few of you who don't know, former state rep, the man who ran in the legendary election against Ray Flynn exactly 30 years ago, and still an activist extraordinaire
into his
80s. But God, I'm sorry.
So you know, I'm in Haley House, and then I meet the owner of Haley House, and he doesn't know me, and Everyone takes me in the back, and I meet the people who work at Haley House. And you know who works at Haley House.
Who?
You know, it's folks who have been refugees or folks that have been released from jail who are trying to make a transition. And they make the most amazing food, and there's this culture and climate there. And I'm engaging with folks that I don't live in that neighborhood, but they have accepted me into their neighborhood. My family comes from that neighborhood. My family comes from Roxbury, but I'm removed two generations from that. But here's what's interesting. I love the fact I can go into a situation and engage with folks and help make a difference in the ground in schools and connections and partnerships. The work we were specifically talking about was the work we're doing around RocksMap between Madison Park and Roxbury Community College, and really about going to scale. But what was interesting for me, as I said, is I like going into places as an outsider in building relationships and bridges and trust and then delivering on promises. That's what good government does. That's why I believe in this governor. And he and I, I tell him this. I said, you know, you've inspired me to make a difference in this world because you believe in people. And I believe in people. Now, I'm a registered Republican and
he's
a Democrat. Yeah, this was all in the paper when they hired me.
I didn't know that.
But guess what? It doesn't mean we have to be on opposite sides of the fence because at the end of the day, it's the people that we serve. And this job's about service and mission. And that's what inspires me every day to get out of bed. I gave my office staff a pep talk on Friday about getting out. What does it mean? Why do we do this? Why do we have to have something to get us out of bed in the morning to go do our work? It's the kids that count on us, right? Kids that count on us. If you keep them at the center... This is the most exciting work happening anywhere. If you forget what your core is, you just become a bureaucrat. And that's not what I want to be. I want to be a game changer, a doer.
Matt Malone is the Secretary of Education. Secretary Malone, before you go, you see over in the corner there? You see it? pick it up, throw it out, will you please? Matt Malone, Secretary of Education. By the way, our apologies. We don't know what happened
Something
with the phones.
Happened, yeah.
Next time he's back, he'll have an opportunity to interact with the Secretary. Secretary, it's great to see you.
Matt Malone is the Secretary of Education, and he still stands by that adage. Jim just said it. Trash is your enemy. Homework is your friend. Thanks again for coming in, Secretary Malone. Up next is the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory, to talk to us about sort of this shenanigans over in Sochi, exorbitant executive pay, journalistic rules at the New York Times bended by letting columnist Nick Kristof post Dylan Farrow's open letter. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Rumor has it that local Chinese restaurants have a secret menu that they don't always share with Americans.
I was offended that somehow I'd gotten the American Chinese menu, because I guess they saw me with my friend who's not Chinese and sort of rounded down.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Secrets in the Chinese food business revealed. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Northeastern University, where this semester's public seminar series, the Myra Kraft Open Classroom, focuses on water issues and their impact on our cities and coastline. You can learn more at northeastern.edu/openclassroom. And the Boston Symphony Orchestra, led by David Newman, playing Bernstein's West Side Story score live with the new remastered film, February 14th through 16th. More information at bso.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Bradley. She's Marjorie. And we're joined, as we are every Wednesday, by the editor of The Globe, the man about whom the new CEO of The Globe, Mike Sheehan, said this to the Boston Business Journal. I think Brian is the best major metro editor in the country. He's a practitioner of the craft. He's an incredible writer. A big part of the reason I am here is because Brian's here. Welcome, Brian McGrory.
Good morning, Jim.
Welcome, Brian McGrory.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Now, Brian, would you agree or disagree with that assessment, please?
Well, I expect Jim to say, and Mike comes to the business having no knowledge of newspapers whatsoever. and now we understand why. But it was nice to get that vote of confidence from Mike. But now we move onward.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Well, that was very lovely, Brian. Very lovely. So, you've got several reporters over in Sochi for the Winter Olympics. An unbelievable story in the front page today by David Filipov about them running around shooting thousands of these stray dogs and their fear that they're going to have a stray dog in the middle of the opening ceremonies on Friday night. And Shira Springer's writing about how they're frantically running around putting down bricks and stuff like that. I mean, this is – and there's stories everywhere about hotel rooms with no doors. This could be a major fiasco.
It's incredible. I mean, they've had – yes, we do have a bunch of people, and I appreciate you pointing that out. And David Filipov has done a remarkably good job already, as has Shira. David had a terrific kind of broad view of what these Olympics really mean for Russia in the Sunday paper, which I thought worked out really well. And I mean, this could be potentially a disaster. Look at take away the issue of killing the stray dogs, take that away, and then just ask the question, why are they doing it now?
Exactly.
Why did they wait for the news media from around the world to arrive? As they start, they use this very antiseptic word, culling the flock of stray dogs. Why didn't they do this months ago? But, you know, the real question is, why do it at all? Why couldn't they round them up and find them homes or send them somewhere else? It's terrible. And the idea that they had years, if not, you know, well over a decade to plan this thing, and you've got hotel rooms without doors, you've got hotels without hot water, you've got the potential for not quite disaster, but for some real bad feelings over there right now.
You know, if you – I don't know if you follow David Filipov on Twitter, but for those who don't out there, it's at David Filipov. In the last 24 hours, he posted a photograph of the outside of a hotel in Sochi, which not only has no doors, has no walls. There is literally – it is a hotel that is uncompleted when they've spent allegedly $51 billion, probably much more. You know, what was really interesting to me – when Shira Springer was in the studio with us a couple of weeks ago, we asked her how Sochi got the Olympics to begin with, when Austria and I think South Korea were right in the running there. And either she was at the IOC International Olympic Committee meeting or she wrote about it or something. And she said Putin came and totally just charmed. Those were her words. Charmed the committee. And then you say to yourself, Barack Obama went to the International Olympic Committee to get the summer games for Chicago, and Chicago came in dead last. I mean, what does that say about the IOC?
Or what does it say about Putin and Obama? I don't know. It's a little crazy. And you factor in that Sochi really, it's not a winter resort. It's a summer resort.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so that makes it even odder. But the key fact here, $51 billion in the estimate to get these games off the ground. The budget was, what, between $5 and $7 billion? Yeah. It makes a big dig in Boston look like the biggest bargain in the history of engineering.
Well put.
You know, there's this picture in your paper, Brian, of Putin with his Persian leopard, stroking the Persian leopard. Maybe that was Barack Obama's problem. He didn't bring a leopard with him when he was talking about Chicago. But anyway.
But the heartbreaking, if I can just interject, the heartbreaking photo is a woman on the front page today with a stray dog.
Yeah.
It looks like German Shepherd mix jumping up on her. It was just awful. The idea that these people are running around with guns killing dogs is... it's really, really hard to accept.
Well, you also say to yourself, I mean, apparently they're running around normally all the time. Can't they find shelters or can't they neuter these dogs so they're not having puppies all over the place? It just says something about the whole society over there, which is pretty creepy.
I mean, I think it's just a different culture. Many years ago, I was the Globe's White House reporter, and I was contemplating going and becoming the Globe's Russian correspondent and living in Moscow.
Really?
David Filipov was then the Russian correspondent. He was in Moscow, and we had a bunch of conversations by phone, and I was ready to pull the trigger and go over and work out of Russia. Jim, can you see me working out of Russia?
I'm about to make a comment. Go ahead. Continue. Yeah.
But in one of our last conversations...
By the way, did they have a Newbury Street in Moscow? I'm not... No, but go ahead.
Nice.
I'm sorry.
That's real nice.
Go ahead.
He says to me, matter-of-factly, as we're about to hang up, and I was about to call Boston and say, listen, I'm ready to go. He says, hey, you don't have a dog, do you? And
God.
I had this golden retriever named Harry, who I utterly adored. And I said, why do you ask? And he said, well, if you bring your dog over, the Russians love to sick their pit bulls on other people's dogs and just watch them get mauled.
Oh, God.
And at that point, any plan to become a foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe quickly came to an end. It's just a different cultural outlook over there.
That is, they love to watch dogs get mauled. Oh, Brian.
Yeah.
Can I tell you one perverse way? Well, I don't want to see the dog. I'm not the kind of dog person you and Marjorie are. But the fact that this is happening, while I would surely not wish it on any dog, at least allows people to see through what I'm guessing is going to be a perfect Olympic Games in terms of the sports and realize what Russia is and what it does. And so in some perverse way, if it's happening, it's good we're seeing it.
Well, is that Jim's way of saying if we have to lose a few dogs?
No, it is not.
That's really bizarre.
No, it is not what I'm saying, but thank you.
Okay, well, we'll move on to another cheerful topic here, Brian McGroy. But I'm just wondering from a journalistic perspective, there's been a lot of blowback. Nicholas Kristof had this column on Sunday about Woody Allen and Dylan Farrow, Maria Farrow's, their adopted daughter, and allegations by Dylan Farrow that she was molested by Allen. And then the New York Times ran this blog. And of course, you know, Kristof is a friend of Maria Farrow, friend
close
of the family.
Friend, apparently.
Yeah. And the blog was just basically Dylan's remembrances. How'd you feel about that? Would you run that in the Boston Globe? A lot of people feel very uncomfortable about this piece of journalism.
It's a really, really good question, and I will confess straight out that I have not been following this as closely as perhaps the entire rest of the world has. I don't find it incredibly interesting, but the journalistic question behind it on whether the Times should have run this, I am uncomfortable with that. I mean, they're putting out there, on one of the premier news sites in the world, something that is completely unfounded. It's an accusation, and, it runs very personal, and it's been explored in past years. And It involves very high-profile people. I have some issues with airing that without doing any rigorous investigation on their own. So I don't know. I don't feel great about that one.
Yeah, the public editor sort of threw.
Well,
him
let me. I actually wrote down what they say. This Fairley Dickinson professor, his name is Rasmussen. I don't know if it's a man or woman. Rasmussen wrote, "I write to ask about the propriety of publishing largely one-sided columns assailing a lone individual. I wonder whether columnists should use that platform to advocate on behalf of personal friends, as Christoph." Did. If Dylan Farrow wishes to publish an open letter about our allegations or ample forums in the internet age, should the Times and Christoph lend their credibility to our argument against Allen? Then Margaret Sullivan, who is the public editor, the ombudsperson, whatever, for the New York Times, responds, quote, "While acknowledging that Times columnists appropriately have very free rein in choosing subject matter and commenting on it as they see fit, I am troubled by the same questions." That's pretty heavy when you're, I mean, I know they're an independent, but when the public editor does, that's a big deal.
It is a big deal, and she's very respected at what she does. And like I said, it's I feel really squeamish about what they did. It's if we're looking at the globe, would we do that up here? Would we allow somebody that kind of voice to take down a very public person and unfounded accusations? I can't say we wouldn't, but it would. The bar would be very, very high in terms of doing it.
So, Brian, I know you relatively well. How are your math skills? I don't know. How are your math skills?
What kind of deeply personal question is
these
that?
I want to quote from two fine pieces in the Boston Globe. Several weeks ago, I think it was Todd Wallach wrote a great piece about the former president of Brandeis. I think we talked to you about this.
Yeah.
Is it Judah Reinhart's? $8 million, it's estimated, he will get post his presidency, $8 million. And then we wake up this morning, actually it was on Boston.com last night, in your paper today, that totally coincidentally, Brandeis is facing a $6.5 million deficit. And as a result of that, they have to buy out, and then if the buyouts don't work, potentially lay off as much as 13% of their non-faculty workforce. Now, I'm trying to not put you in a very tough position as editor as opposed to opinion columnist. If you were a student at Brandeis, let's put it this way, and you found out that the former president got $8 million, and 13% of the staff at the school has to be laid off because of a deficit a little short of $8 million. What would your reaction be as a student there,
Brian? It's crazy. I mean, come on. And even take out the buyouts that are about to be launched and the $6.5 million deficit, it's crazy that tuitions are going up at the rate they are year after year, that kids are taking loans or leaving school incredibly indebted. Parents are working two and three jobs. They're taking home equity lines of credit on their house. It is mind-boggling that they are doing all that, and the Brandeis board is so blind to it, so tone-deaf, that they are giving this kind of money to a former president. It makes no sense whatsoever.
No, and you're right. But Marjorie and I were discussing, well, it's with Charlie Baker, I guess, yesterday and
yes.
The day before, discussing the fact that it is stunning while Congress and bought into this, as I said, this orgasmic celebration of themselves for having cut the interest rate on student loans in half, which saved the average subsidized student loan taker $6 a month. The fact that there's no leading politician who has come up with a credible, supportable plan to deal with college tuitions, particularly in the face of this kind of crap,
well, the government, the Warren
thing, is unbelievable.
And don't forget the Elizabeth Warren thing.
Right, $66 billion in profits over 6 years for the federal government from these. Does it not amaze you that somebody with a brain doesn't glom? Well, I guess to a degree, Warren is, but someone doesn't glom onto this and ride this baby right to the whatever.
No, you're right, and I mean Warren would be a good person to do that. Boston is obviously a hotbed for higher education, so it would be good if somebody came out of here doing it. But look, you know as I know that a lot of people believe that the next bubble isn't in housing costs or anything like that. It's in higher education.
Absolutely.
And that the nation quite simply can't afford these tuitions that are now running $55,000-$60,000 a year. And it's only contributing to the unbelievable level of inequality we have in this society when education and college is unaffordable to vast numbers of people.
Well, then you also have the economic issue. We have a young man upstairs who works here was saying that, you know, when you're still paying your college loans back well into your 30s, if not your 40s, you can't afford to buy a house. You're worried about having children. You're worried about starting all those things in normal life that contributes to the economy and blah, blah, blah. So it's just a snowball effect.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. Maybe I'm being too loose calling college a consumer good, but what other consumer good does quality become relatively irrelevant? The same elite schools basically cost the same as middle of the road
schools.
That's right. And there's no distinction. There's no schools that offer bargains, or you're seeing stories now where some are trying to come out front on that and cut tuitions to make them more affordable. But for the most part, especially up here in the north, in the northeast, any school costs the same.
$60,000 private sector.
Yeah. Whether it's Harvard or Suffolk.
Yeah. Aside from state schools, especially in Massachusetts, the costs have risen on those. They are far more affordable than the private options, but they're not cheap either by any stretch.
You know, one of my favorite factoids, it was in your Sunday Globe magazine, a great piece published by a part-time columnist.
Oh, yes,
you deserve praise for that.
Every word.
This guy wrote that that Barack Obama, this is unbelievable, stop laughing. Barack Obama paid off his law school loans, I believe it was a year before he went into the White House.
Yes.
It is just unbelievable.
I have that column cut up on the wall here. I'm just referring
Brian,
to it right now.
Jim is hoping that you're going to submit his work in the Boston Globe magazine for Pulitzer this year.
Why wouldn't he?
He's ready.
Okay, now, Brian.
He's ready.
His laughter is really demeaning to me.
Oh, I needed that. Thank you, Marjorie. Thanks.
Now, since we're on this this quiz front.
He's still
and this
laughing,
is all
Jim.
I know he is. Well, it will be dealt with appropriately. Now, I'm going to read you two quotes from the Boston Globe. You ready? And you have to tell me who wrote them and what was the subject matter. They're very similar. Okay, you ready?
I'm not sure.
Good.
Already, but go ahead.
The ceilings have linear Tuscan. The personal gym is carpeted and has glass-tiled walls. The laboratory is finished in carved block stone. That's one of them. The next one is the property boasts a two-car garage, a pantry equipped with a wine cellar, a courtyard draped with wisteria and ivy, and a guest house. Who wrote them? Well, you don't care who wrote them. What are they both about? Do you know? Two different things.
I know the first one.
What was that?
The first one is about the executive suite at Liberty Mutual.
Yeah, who wrote that?
I'm forgetting who wrote it.
That was you.
It was remarkably well done is all I remember.
That was a 30-part series on the opulence at Liberty Mutual by Brian McGorry, columnist. And do you know what the second one describes?
No, the second one, you're losing me.
This was written, I don't know who wrote it, and I'm embarrassed to say I don't know who wrote it.
I think it was Lisa.
Lisa Wangsness.
Yes.
Oh,
the other day.
The second one came from, oh my God, the second one was this past month.
Right, about Reverend Trinity. Lloyd from Trinity Church. The
what
property
a great
boasts
story.
A two-car
what a
garage,
story.
A pantry equipped with a wine cellar, courtyard draped with wisteria and ivy, and a guest house, and the cost is $3.6 million. Dollars.
And it also had a Tuscan feel, according to Ahern, the realtor down there in the back.
Kevin Ahern, great realtor.
Yes, Tuscan feel.
So what's your analysis? You know, if somebody is, I don't know how to voice this, but I'll do my best. Why is it that there is no shame anymore in terms of whether it's a man of the cloth who's living in a $3.6 million thing?
With a Tuscan feel.
Or a guy who's making $50 million a year, as you wrote, over 4 years, and all the planes and all the other greats. There's no shame. Why is it?
Well, first, the guy who was making $50 million a year over 4 years, so $200 million, wasn't the same guy that renovated the office for $4.5 million, a 1,300-square-foot office. So that's different. I just want to make sure we're straight on that.
That was his successor, correct?
That was his successor. He's actually a very good guy.
But, so I hear, actually.
It's interesting. When they renovated the office, they actually had to shut down Stewart Street for a while so they could lift up the new air conditioning and heating systems up to the, I think, is the seventh floor above, but
did they
all
really?
All for good cause.
Did they really
cause.
Shut
they
down
did.
Stewart Street? Oh
they
my
did,
God!
Yeah. But to your point on Trinity Church and the rector and the $3.6 million house on Chestnut Street on Beacon Hill, look, I'm not going to give you any analysis on that, Jim, despite the baiting, but I think it was worth reporting. I think it was something that is definitely in the public interest. You know, the vestry at Trinity Church decided that this was a good investment to make. They had a $50 million endowment. They figured that they put half, they gave half of the cost of the house as a down payment. And they look at it as something that is a good diversification of their endowment. Others have looked at it and said $3.6 million seems to be an awful lot of money for a house for somebody of the cloth. And, you know, we just present the facts and let it go from there.
Well, it's interesting. Lisa Wang's, this is a great reporter. She did a great job. We have a great staff. One of the things our staff looked up as we were having this discussion the other day is part of the argument by the leaders of the church was we need him in close proximity to the church because he works 12 to 14 hour days. We invited him on, by the way, and he has not yet come on. They did a Google map thing and demonstrated that his house on Chestnut Street is the exact same distance from Trinity Church as is Lower Roxbury. So if he wanted to be in close proximity to the church, he could live there, probably at greater cost, be amongst the people and those sort of
things.
So,
yes. Yes. Yeah, I mean, look to their defense, and I can't believe you're putting me in a position to defend them.
No, go ahead and do it. Defend them.
You might argue that it's a sounder investment to be on Beacon Hill, and you'll see less fluctuation. But, I mean, come on. You couldn't find a place for $1.5 million or $2 million on Commonwealth Ave or Marlborough Street. I mean, that's $3.6 million. It's a lot of money, and we thought it was important to point that out.
We studied
the pictures for about 15 minutes on the
online,
real estate site. It was really something.
Brian, last thing. Did you figure out how to work Netflix yet, or are you still fumbling with that, or what?
I am halfway there. I am. I've got the control manual out, and I am almost ready to see.
Watch Mitt.
So you haven't seen Mitt yet, then?
Yeah. Now, do you need a when you do Netflix? Do you have a special Netflix machine, or do you just do it on your TV or computer? How does that work?
Yeah, you'd need it. Yeah, we'll have one delivered to the Globe later today.
You have to have a fancy TV though to do Netflix on the TV.
No, you
right?
don't. No, you don't.
You can't do
it
on an old TV.
You need a box, Marjorie. Is what you need. Can I tell you one last thing?
You can do it on a regular TV.
Hey,
I don't think so.
Chelsea or John, what's the name of the Kevin Spacey show I was talking about this morning?
House of Cards.
House of Cards. If you don't have Netflix, you haven't seen House of Cards yet. I watched the first episode.
It's
the second season, and you'll love it, Brian. About politics, White House politics, since that's where you spent a piece of your life, starring Kevin Spacey. I saw the first episode last night from a year ago. It is brilliant. So when you do your Netflix thing, you have a couple of things you can check
out. I will do that. I'm a big TV guy. Is Welcome Back Carter still on?
Yeah. By the way, Epstein's mother, was she great or what?
She was great.
That what a great show.
Goodbye, Brian.
I saw Henry Winkler on TV doing reverse mortgage ads.
You already went to college?
Henry Winkler?
Emerson.
I did not know that.
I believe I'm right. Hey, Brian, great to talk to you. Talk to you next week.
Jim, always great. Thank you, Marjorie.
Thank you, Brian. Brian McGroy is editor of the Boston Globe. He joins us every Wednesday. Coming up, we're going to talk to medical ethicist Art Kaplan about addiction and the accountability doctors should bear when they prescribe prescription painkillers. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
In Pakistan, the Bhutto family represents generations of prime ministers who have been killed. Now 25-year-old Bilawal Bhutto Zardari steps into politics.
The very forces that people are scared of in this country assassinated my mother. I'm not scared of them. I want to defeat them.
The heir to the Bhutto dynasty, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you. and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Roman Catacomb Mystery from WGBH's Nova. Descend into ancient Roman tunnels for a forensic investigation into what killed the catacombs' inhabitants. Watch Nova Wednesday at 9 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Recently, Vermont's Governor Shumlin's State of the Union address focused solely on the extreme heroin problem that's ravaging his state. And only days later, as you know, actor Philip Seymour Hoffman died from an apparent overdose. He was found with a needle in his arm and many empty bags of heroin next to him. For a lot of heroin users, Philip Seymour Hoffman included, the path to heroin is paved with prescription painkillers. Joining us on the line for his take on what responsibility the medical community has when it comes to prescribing the kinds of painkillers that can be the gateway drug to dirtier and cheaper fixes is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. Also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art, great to talk to you again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hi, Art. You wrote a great piece about doctors and prescribing painkillers. But before we get to that, I think a lot of us have this notion that if you have a serious heroin problem, you're sort of not functioning very well. And yet we have this actor, Philip Seymour Hoffman, who seemed to be a quite high-functioning heroin addict.
There are high-functioning heroin addicts, just like there are high-functioning cocaine addicts. Heroin certainly can give you a high, but it's one that you can, if you will, go to work with. There are a lot of folks, I think, out there who'd be shocked that heroin use is big, even among college students. It's really had a comeback, and it's a drug that I think is especially pernicious because highly addictive. The way you use it can get you in trouble, but it doesn't, so to speak, leave you just nodding off in an alleyway, that kind of cinema version of what we think of as heroin addiction.
And there's also, you don't have to shoot it. You can also snort it, right?
Correct.
What's the difference?
It just gets you high faster when you snort it. It's just also there are people who think the needles can get me in trouble if they're dirty, and there are people basically who are needle phobic. They don't like needles.
You know, shortly after Peter Shumlin gave his State of the State address several weeks ago, one of my colleagues at New England Cable News who covers Vermont said, you know, he gave his whole speech on the heroin epidemic there. And I said, his whole speech? Mm-hmm. And they said, yes, his whole speech. So is the moral of that story in Vermont, which to people like me is the most unlikely place to be having that kind of problem, and what happened to Hoffman, are they the same? What is the moral of those two stories?
Well, I think the moral is, first of all, there's a little bit of a, you know, years ago, tuberculosis was kind of a romantic disease. Poets and actors and artists and cool people got tuberculosis. It was kind of the dramatic disease. Heroin addiction has a little bit of the glamour today. Rock stars do it. Actors do it. You kind of have this idea that it's a little bit hip, and I think that's dangerous. So the culture promotes that a little bit, and it's trouble. You know, you see the reactions to the death of this famous actor, and you don't want to romanticize the bad habit, but it kind of gets a glow from the kind of users, if you will, not just homeless people or unemployed people or very, very poor people. It's got an upper class, even rich person's drug. Another problem in terms of, you know, why devote your whole address to it? Well, it's rampant. I think people don't understand that drug addiction, including heroin, is a bigger problem than all those chronic diseases we hear about, like the cancer and the heart disease. We really have a drug abuse problem in this country. We have an alcohol abuse problem, a nicotine addiction problem. So addiction is major. Last time I looked, those who are addicted, 1 out of 10 are getting treatment of any kind.
Why? Because they don't want it or they can't find it?
I think they can't find it. And I think it's one of the big scandals of American healthcare. We're talking about health reform. We're supposed to have more parity. Remember that term in,
yes.
Between physical and mental health?
Yeah, that hasn't panned out, has it?
Well, you know why? It's because, yeah, you can give people some insurance coverage, but if you don't have the providers, if you don't have the people to give the care, then it doesn't matter if you have an insurance card. So there aren't enough providers out there. The programs are full. I don't have to tell listeners this. Just think, if you were trying to get your kid into a drug abuse program,
right,
boy, you're going to have a hard time finding anybody that has a space.
Yep. Yeah.
And
you
part
hear that, you hear that all the time, about mental health stuff as well.
And, and make the connection that so many are making now, Art, about this OxyContin thing, both the shortage and the cost as compared to the availability and the lower cost of heroin.
Well, you've got basically a prescription crisis in the United States. So people want painkillers, and there's a legitimate use for them, but doctors overprescribe them, and there are crooks out there who really overprescribe them. So prescription drug abuse, particularly painkillers, we just haven't gone right at that problem. You'd think that if people were prescribing, they'd have to turn their records over maybe to drug enforcement officials or the cops just to check to make sure they're not running a some kind of a mill to give pain medications out there, and they don't. So we've got that problem is out there with a lot of those drugs floating along. What happens is kids get into the medicine cabinet. If I was going to give one bit of practical advice today, I'd say lock up your medicines, your prescription drugs. That's where kids find them, use them, take them, swap them. So you got to really treat those as dangerous substances, not just because they have a childproof cap on them, but you got to put them somewhere where people can't find them or steal them. Once they get onto the OxyContin and that sort of stuff, the road to heroin, because it's cheap, is pretty fast. That's probably the pathway drug, you know, the gateway drug. We used to hear about marijuana that way, but I think it's prescription drug abuse leading over to the cheap heroin option.
And how much of a middle-class issue is this? I mean, one of the ways we, I think most of us chose to be blind to this issue was it's them. It's not us. It's not our neighbors. That's not so true, is it, or is it?
No, it isn't. You know, when if we go back a little bit like the Radio Shack commercial from the Super Bowl to the 80s, you know, we had the cop guys chasing the heroin addicts who were nodding off in the back alleys or shooting up in shooting galleries and all that sort of thing. They're still out there. There are plenty of people dead in a place like North Philadelphia, you know, every day. But it's become, that's what I meant when I said got a little bit of a romantic and a cool aspect to heroin. So it's spread out to the middle class. It's spread out to the upper class. You hear that artists and creative people say, yeah, you know, I use it. I can function. It's a cool thing to do, and that is big trouble.
We're talking with Art Kaplan, the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. You know, I've heard both sides, you know, just anecdotally, Art Kaplan, that people go in, I mean, high school kids, maybe they were injured playing sports, and they go in, and I've heard this, you know, they get painkillers, and they become hooked on the painkillers. Then you hear the other side, where people are in terrible pain and can't get enough of painkillers. So there seems to be a schizophrenia going on here.
There is, Marjorie. You know, I have a lot of sympathy for people who have their pain undertreated or don't get it acknowledged. There's certainly studies that keep popping up saying, you know, particularly for minority people, they don't get real pain treated aggressively for whatever reason. People aren't as sympathetic, doctors, nurses.
Really?
Yep. There's definitely a disparity there. And then flipped around, you've got this huge epidemic of prescription drug abuse, people running into, you know, just crooked doctors and getting these prescriptions written all over the United States. Now, if you really wanted me to sort of make the call, I'll say this. The epidemic is worse than the undertreatment. We got to get on top of this epidemic.
You know, I'm going to, I guess, ask or make a thoroughly uninformed statement, and you'll disabuse me.
Okay.
I'm the guy to make it.
Yeah,
no, I'm going to make it, not you. Is as you're talking, you and Marjorie particularly are talking about the breadth of this crisis, what comes into my mind is we have these impassioned debates about whether or not we should allow medicinal marijuana. We just licensed the first 20 dispensaries in Massachusetts. They're debating all over the country, should we take the big step to allow doctors to prescribe marijuana? Are we even close to having as much of a discussion about this overprescribing of painkillers and this heroin epidemic as we are about medical marijuana?
No. Marijuana has its lobbies, and it has a kind of image as very safe, something that, you know, if you're going to have cigarettes or you're going to have alcohol, then why aren't we looking at marijuana? Meanwhile, at the other end of the drug world, we have this explosion of drug abuse. More people die now from prescription drug abuse than do from abuse of heroin, cocaine, and crack cocaine and the illegal drugs. So we are completely, how to put this in ethics terms, out of our mind.
So
on this whole subject, we don't get it straight. We aren't wrestling with it correctly.
So one last thing before we move on from this. So what should we be doing?
I think a couple of things. First, we got to set up more incentives for people to go into the addiction field to treat addicts.
Yep.
More places, more programs. If doctors don't want to do it because it doesn't pay enough, then nurses should do it. If nurses don't want to do it, nurse assistants should do it. You know, you got to get the manpower out there to grapple with this thing. Get tough on docs who misprescribe. We just aren't prosecuting them. We're not tracking them. You want to prescribe these drugs, you better turn all your information over regularly to police authorities to have it assessed. I mean, you got to play ball here, given the nature of the problem. Third thing, let's actually ask Hollywood to make prescription drug abuse and heroin abuse uncool. That would be helpful in the culture. We did it with cigarettes. We could do it here.
Hey, we're talking to Art Kaplan. Art, move from doctors misbehaving or some doctors misbehaving to some doctors doing the human thing. There's a story in the New York Times a couple of days ago when doctors give patients money. I've thought about this a lot, and I never read anything about it till the other day. Is a doctor who is also a human, which is not oxymoronic at all. In fact, generally, at least in my experience,
Metafew,
they are both, is you make a prescription and it's pretty clear that the person to whom you're giving the prescription can't afford the copay or can't afford whatever it is, some what would seem as a minor expenditure to a doctor, and a doctor gives the $20 to the patient. It never occurred to me. I was wondering why it wasn't done more. It never occurred to me there's an issue, an ethical issue, a professional issue. What's the issue?
Well, I think it's a Band-Aid. That's what the issue is. I think it's great when a caring doctor, or for that matter, a caring policeman decides to give his coat or help somebody. They're really acting from the most admirable ethical impulse.
So do I.
But the problem is you can't run the system that way. You know, the guy who doesn't have the copay today, he doesn't have it next week, and he doesn't have it next month, and he doesn't have it next year. So it's not a fix. I think that's where the problem lies. You're kind of, you know, it's a little bit like giving a guy in the street some money. It's okay. I understand why people want to do it, but we haven't really solved the problem of the homeless person or the person who can't get a job. You got to get them a house and a job.
Yeah, but let's do the flip side. I'm glad to hear you say that. Well, I'm glad to hear you say that there's not a problem other than the fact that some people see it as a Band-Aid and then maybe they think the problem disappears. What if you're a doctor and you prescribe something that you know is critical to the well-being of your patient, and you are also aware that this person has no ability to afford it, and the likelihood of him or her actually going and getting the drug is borders on zero? What obligation, if any, I don't mean to take $20 mm-hmm. out of their wallet, what obligation, if any, does the doctor, the nurse, the healthcare provider have to pursue this in some fashion to help ensure that that person actually gets what they need? Is there any
I would say morally we try to encourage our docs and nurses to do that, to really think, well, how can I get the system to do it? But let me tell you one tricky path. Sometimes drug companies who sell the name brand drugs, not the cheap ones, say, we'll give you the free samples. And so the doctor turns around and says, ooh, right in the medicine cabinet, I've got some free ones. But then you start the person on that drug, and pretty soon they're asking for that drug, and that was the high-priced one. So even there, you got to navigate carefully. Just because something's free for the initial couple of samples, coming back to our drug model in terms of how dealers get you hooked, you may still want to go with a generic first and try that. So there are things to do. There are also programs that hospitals have. Some of the drug companies have some programs to help. So solving those problems is important. Now, do doctors have a lot of time to do it? Is that the real solution? No, you got to really do health reform and say if the copays are a barrier for really needed drugs, then we got to get rid of copays for very poor people.
You know what we need? I know this is a ridiculous idea. We need something like, I don't know, like a federal, I don't know, Affordable Care Act or something.
something
don't
like
you
that.
Think so? I know that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that. Is the much maligned Obamacare, if it gets up to speed, going to resolve any of the – it's not going to resolve food stamp problems.
You know what's really missing here?
What?
We haven't had a hearing in Congress yet on prices. So we're yammering on here about, give the $20. So Well, why does the drug cost $490 billion in the first place?
Well, research. That's what we always hear, Art Kaplan.
And I believe it. So here's the question. My farmer friends will sometimes send me, if we don't charge these high prices in the United States, then we can't do our research. And my attitude is, you mean I'm subsidizing the French? I'm going to give cheap prices to Japan? We're in a completely lunatic situation. We're underwriting research for the pharmaceutical industry, so the rest of the world except us can get cheaper prices? Just asking.
You know what Art said a second ago? I misheard. I thought he said my farmer friends, and I had a totally different view of Art Kaplan.
Not the farmers. No, the pharma.
I got it.
So, Art Kaplan, we read also in the New York Times that the doctor's white coat may be a thing of the past soon, that there's all this concern about what doctors wear to minimize infection risk. What's this about? Bare below the elbows and all this kind of stuff?
So it turns out that one of the most infectious transmitting things in all of healthcare is the necktie. It sticks on things, gets jammed into places. It is a mess. And when infectious disease guys sort of measure where the bacteria are and where the nasty organisms are, that's one place. The other place turns out to be the white coat. Now, we don't have great data on this, but it looks like people don't launder their coats enough.
The
hospitals don't say, hey, you know, like at the end of every 2 days, you better wash this thing, and here's the laundry ticket, go do it. So they're not making it easy to clean the damn things. And you have this infection. You know, we wash our hands and then march into the patient's room with a filthy coat that's been God knows where.
Oh, God.
So that's what the problem is. And by the way, emotionally, one of the big moments for doctors these days is to get their white coat. We have white coat ceremonies. That's how we start them. So it's sort of like saying, hey, here's something that's really nasty that's going to kill people. Congratulations, you're now in medical school.
You know, beyond what it means, it's sort of like getting the green jacket at the Masters,
yeah.
I guess, if you win in Augusta.
Yeah.
But what does that apparel mean to the patient? I mean, most of us grew up with the notion that the guy or woman who comes to see you,
absolutely,
is supposed to be wearing the white coat. You don't want your, well, you know what I mean. There's uniform, and so how much does them departing from the tradition affect the patient's view of who they are and what they are? Do you know what I mean?
I do. I understand it completely. You want your magical healer to come dressed in the right magical uniform.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's white, and it's even better sometimes if they wear those little hats with the, hair protectors on them. And if they have big microscopic things on their glasses, I'm getting all excited about getting yield all of a sudden. So, yeah, the shift probably is short sleeve white coats, not long sleeve, launder them frequently. I don't think they have to disappear. They just have to be designed better so that they don't bring infection along. And then, the culture will slowly start to accommodate a change in what it expects from its healers. But there's always going to be some way to identify the doc, if for no other reason than practical. So you do need, you got to have your name badge on. Somebody's got to be able to look down the hall and see where the doctor is if they need them. It isn't just ceremony. There's practical reasons, too.
You know, when I see an MD, and I'm a big pro-doctor person, when I see MD on a license plate, it drives me totally out of my mind.
Not me. I'll drive near them just in case.
What's analogous? Do some young docs wear these white coats out in the world to sort of say to the world, I am? Yeah,
oh,
they
yeah.
do,
they
right?
Do?
Of course they do.
Oh, yeah,
never
yeah,
seen
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And a few just wear them because, they just wear them. It's kind of like your backpack or something. You kind of put it on and run around back and forth. But both happen. They do. There's nothing more impressive than going out to have a cup of coffee with your buddies and put that white coat on.
I'm going to buy one, actually, as soon as the segment's over.
And we're talking with Art Kaplan.
I have to tell you one other thing.
What?
The length of the coat matters, too.
It does?
If you buy one, yeah, get a long one. It means you're more senior.
I did not know that. All right, Kaplan, we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you real quickly about a really upsetting story in the Boston Globe about a 56-year-old man who underwent a transplant. His brother-in-law had end-stage liver disease and liver cancer, and the donor, the 56-year-old, died at the Lahey Clinic in Burlington. I assume this is unusual.
Highly unusual. So it's part of the reason, though, that when we hear all these proposals rattling around, why don't we pay people? Maybe more people would come forward and donate a kidney or a piece of their liver. There's real risks in those donations. They're not huge. They're tiny, probably. on the order of 1 in 7,500 risks of death, but it's not zero. So complications arise, infections happen, anesthesia always carries a risk. I really think people who do it are noble and great, but you can't get away from the reality that sometimes when you get an operation that's that serious, taking out a piece of your liver, for example, you do face some risk of dying.
Does a high-profile story like this, where the bad outcome for the noble soul, and I couldn't agree with you more, who chooses to do this, does that, is there evidence that suggests it discourages, at least in the short run, people, unless the person's their kid or their spouse,
right,
from doing a similar thing?
You know, a little bit. Not as much as you might think, because most of these things take place between family members, and they're willing to take those risks. And for the most part, you know, the decision about helping your brother goes like this. Of course I'm going to do it, or I'm never going to do that. You kidding? I'm not that guy. I don't like it. So, nah, I wouldn't say the risk drives it overly much. Tiny bit.
Now, Art Kaplan, you are a medical doctor. Are you wearing a white coat right now?
No.
He's not.
No, you're not?
I am a PhD.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know if I feel the same way about you now, Art Kaplan. I thought you
were an
MD.
I'd get a white jacket if I were you,
Art.
And
a white jacket. Okay.
Well, something, by the way, in the hospital, I never wear, interestingly enough, because I don't want people to get confused. When I'm coming around doing those medical ethics consults, I want them to be clear. There's the doc, and here's me.
Okay.
The difference.
I have seen you on TV. You are not in the
Art,
white coat.
While we have seen you, while we've never met you in person, I have to say one of the things I admire about you most is you are a PhD who does not request that people call you Dr. Kaplan. So I'm not kidding.
Okay.
That, you get a lot of points for that one.
PhD Dr. Kaplan is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. Thanks so much, Art, for being with
us.
Love to talk to you. He co-edited the new book called Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. And you can hear him on Hard Choices, the medical ethics show on Sirius XM Radio, February 3rd and February 7th from 2 to 3 p.m. Up next, we've got Jeff McCormick, the independent candidate who is running for governor. That conversation on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
We deliver next time on The World, the Pizza Box Challenge.
It has to transport the pizza, retain heat, and get rid of moisture.
Scott Wiener has written the book on pizza boxes. He's collected hundreds from as far away as India and Brazil. Many designs and materials, all to meet the same challenge.
You can't deliver a pizza that's cold.
In search of the perfect pizza box, next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LaheyHealth.org. That's LaheyHealth.org. And Brown University's pre-college summer programs, where students can prepare for college success, experience college life, and make new friends from around the world. More than 300 courses available. Brown.edu/summer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. It's a long story. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is Jeff McCormick. Jeff's a Boston-based businessman, is running for governor, is independent. One of his investments, which continues to pay off, is in Boston Duck Boat Tours, and we're guessing that's how he made it today. Jeff, it's great to see you.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Did you ride a duck boat? Did you do a duck boat thing today, or how'd you get here?
Not today, but there certainly have been days that I wish I owned one.
They are great. They are
They are pretty good in the snow. They're so heavy. And you also, Jeff McCormick, are a man bearing gifts. You brought a present here for my colleague, Mr. Browdy.
Well, nice. What is it?
Please describe.
I did. It's a milk carton.
It is.
Because you claim that nobody knows who the hell I am.
That's exactly. I said they could find him on a milk carton.
They could find him on the back of a milk carton because obviously the guy is missing. So I brought a custom-made one for you.
But notice it's organic and low-fat with a photograph of Jeff on the back
of it. It's lovely.
Last seen at Amrine's restaurant in Southie wearing – oh, you're a lacrosse star, weren't you?
I played lacrosse.
Fastest-growing sport in America.
100 years ago. I did know that.
Jeff McCormick, it's a pleasure. thanks so much for joining us. And
thank
thanks
you.
For the gift.
We oh, you're quite welcome.
So, Jeff McCormick, tell people that maybe not be that familiar, because, of course, you are on this milk carton. Why are you running for governor? Why do you want to do this?
Well, I've been building companies for 25 years, and I sincerely believe that we have a lot of structural problems, and the companies we built in areas like education, energy, healthcare, they're areas that are extremely important to the Commonwealth right now. And the other thing is, I believe what we need to do is get small businesses really on track for growth. That is where the job growth comes from. That is the, you know, the rising tide, if you will, that lifts all boats. So since that's my skill set, that's something I bring to bear, and I think it's a good application of it.
Well, you talked about some technology solutions to some of the problems that the Commonwealth faces in different agencies. Like what?
Well, for instance, in healthcare, there's a lot of technologies that could be brought to bear that increase efficiencies tremendously, which decreases the cost of healthcare and greatly improves the outcomes in healthcare. And that's really what you want, right? We want to maintain the great outcomes we can get in the Commonwealth, but we certainly need to do it in a way that we decrease the cost. That has a ripple effect into business because, especially for small businesses, this growing healthcare cost is really starting to choke their growth.
Now, on this front, though, since you mentioned healthcare, and I'm going to get to your bio in a second so that people do get to know you better for those who don't. Charlie Baker, the likely Republican nominee, he's got an opponent too. Obviously, in addition to working for Weldon Solucci and that sort of thing, was at head of Harvard Pilgrim and credited by most people with rescuing it from a mess. You're quoted in the Globe and elsewhere saying he's not an innovator. Particularly since you brought up healthcare, is Charlie Baker not an innovator when it comes to healthcare reform?
Well, I don't see Harvard Pilgrim, for example, as being terribly innovative, and I don't know anyone who does. So I think that when you look at what small companies do, and I'm talking about companies that have single-digit numbers of employees when they start growing them into substantial companies, they have to be innovative. I mean, that's how they carve their way into the world with better solutions that increase efficiencies and such.
But he does deserve praise for the rescue. Does
oh, there's
not,
not
even
oh,
if you use,
oh,
wouldn't
I'm not,
use the word innovator.
Oh, I'm not at all suggesting he's not, you know, strong financially or, you know, whatever financial engineering they needed to do, cost cutting, you know, that sort of thing, you know, which is a different skill set, quite candidly.
Tell us about – give us a little bio. I mean, I know you're an independent now. You were of a party until recently. Give us a little political bio and, you know, sort of the Cliff Notes version.
Yeah, the very short one is grew up in a very, very modest family neighborhood in upstate New York. Happened to be good at sports and in school, so that was kind of my ticket to be able to attend a college or university, parlayed that in as a scholar athlete into paying for grad school, moved here, been here for over half my life, and started a company more than 20 years ago to invest in these early stage entrepreneurs that had great solutions to problems. At the time, most of them were considered very radical, even though some of them are now just the fabric of what we do every day.
We know you've given money to Republicans. You've given money to Democrats. How long have you been unenrolled in Massachusetts?
I've only been unenrolled, I think, for a couple of years. I've been registered as a Republican. I've given a lot more money to Democrats. You know,
wait a minute. You were registered as a Republican, gave a lot more money to Democrats. Why?
Well, registered as a Republican because I've got pretty hands-off social views. I think people ought to manage their own lives.
Yep.
And I think people do a better job of managing their own lives than governments typically do. But I also thought that the driving force for me was we've got to be smarter financially. We have to do what the private sector does, employ technologies, drive efficiencies, drive the outcomes, accountability throughout the system, things in government that we just don't do well.
So as a hands-off guy, would you vote for the legalization of marijuana? Should it be on the ballot in 2016?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because of the legalization of marijuana. I think the first step is we should see where the 35 licenses go. And
for the medical marijuana.
Yeah, I'm sorry, for the medical
dispensaries,
marijuana.
Yeah.
That's right.
But when you say social liberal, I assume that means that you're what you usually think of in those terms, pro-gay marriage.
Absolutely.
Pro-choice.
Absolutely.
Pro-anything else that Republicans usually aren't. I assume you're pro birth control.
The one thing that you say, with I think we've got strong gun control laws.
Yeah.
I think they need to be kept as strong gun control
in
laws
Massachusetts.
In Massachusetts, but I I think a lot of the solutions to the violence we're seeing right now. It's about getting into the communities and really getting the communities to work together. And I know there are a lot of groups doing it. In fact, I was just with a group in Roxbury.
Let's talk about your political bio for a minute.
Sure.
Who'd you vote for in the last two gubernatorial elections?
So in the last two ones, I voted for Patrick.
Patrick and both of them. And what's you gave us your short version of your business bio. What's your political public service bio? I mean, what kind of public service things? What's your history in the part of the world that you want to move?
When you're talking about political.
Public service
The second I had two nickels to rub together because I put everything I had into my company when I started it 20-some years ago, immediately I started supporting everything I could, especially as it related to kids. Christine, my wife, and I have been co-chairs of Bostonians for Youth, which is raising money for at-risk kids. Excuse me. I also the Sean McDonough Charity for Children, which is an omnibus charity for dozens and dozens and dozens of different charities, obviously focused on children, supporting the healthcare organizations, supporting the arts organizations throughout the Commonwealth is also very important.
You just said you were over in Roxbury. What were you doing?
I was actually over there just talking to people, meeting different folks, visiting the Reggie Lewis Center, and hearing about some of the good work that they're doing there. Again, getting back to the community, because I think so many of the solutions are going to have to come from communities being knit together. It's not about just throwing money at things.
What do you mean communities knit together?
Well, part of the social fabric obviously has unraveled a little bit, and one of the roles government can play is to actually see what government can do, but also see what different groups within communities, see what the philanthropic community will do, and get people to work in concert together. What is interesting when you look at, for instance, what's going on with gangs.
Right.
What do gang members, what do all kids need? You know, kids need community. Kids also need consistency, which is very, very important. Kids are also driven to safety. If you think about it, gangs provide all of that. They just provide it in a very, very negative sense. So if you can provide that through organizations, again, like the Reggie Lewis Center and many others, and I've done this through a number of charities, right, including last year running the Boston Marathon, believe it or not, for the prevention of urban violence. Everything we did to prevent urban violence was to pull kids away from gangs and give them a sense of that community, a sense of that security in a very positive way. And that made a difference in their lives.
Well, one of the things that, of course, people have talked about ad nauseum is that the Boston schools need to be able to give kids an education in Boston, particularly the high schools, which are very tough. What's your school ideas for the inner cities, Boston, Lawrence, Lowell?
Well, it's not just for the inner cities. We actually have a company that helps kids with an extremely important area of mathematics.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
It's technology-driven. It's cheap, $16 a kid per year. The average kid gets a 30% improvement in a year. It's being used all over the country. And, you know, so teachers get, you know, better performance from their students.
This is online tutoring.
It's an online program, which ultimately, if you don't understand a concept, you'll flip to a live teacher. So we employ hundreds and hundreds of certified United States math teachers. This isn't a call getting flipped to, you know, some, you know, Asian country. And the kids really get it. And for them to master this, once they do that, there's a far less likelihood of them dropping out of high school, which, as you know, has, you know, chronic unemployment issues and then incarceration issues. So, hey, instead of putting a Band-Aid on it at the end of the line, once they're incarcerated, how about we go back to where the problem starts and try and fix that? And when you look at the cost benefit, it's just a return on investment analysis. I mean, it's a no-brainer.
That's a voice, by the way, if you're just tuned in to Jeff McCormick. He, as of yesterday, is an announced independent candidate for a governor of Massachusetts. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
No, I was just going to say about this education. You know, one of the hot-button issues, of course, is how many public schools versus charter schools should we have, and how long should the school day be, and how should teachers be paid based on their performance, merit pay for teachers? What about some of those things?
Well, none of these are the issues are very definitely complicated. When you talk about charter schools, you have to be very careful there because there are some great examples of charter schools that have worked. And there, you talk to mayors around the Commonwealth and around the country, by the way, a lot of mayors are not in favor of it because, for instance, it's an area that can support one high school. So if you start to pull out a lot of the better students and they actually kind of get selected almost by their families. With more family structure, of course, a charter school is going to get better outcomes. And then the public school has less and less resources and, you know, a less supportive community, if you will, to do well. So they'd rather just do a better job with what they've got.
So you're not keen on more charter schools,
well,
obviously?
Well, again, not as a blanket policy. Okay. I'm keen on driving decisions to the most local level. So in that case, if mayors had more control and power, that would be very, very helpful because in some communities, there are some great examples of charter schools. But people know their communities at the local level better than folks in the state and certainly better than the federal level.
Yeah, you know, one more quick education question. We just had the Secretary of Education and Matt Malone, a bundle of enthusiasm talking about education. And he mentioned that he used to be the superintendent of schools up in Swampscott where Charlie Baker lives and his kids went to public school. Have you sent your kids to public school or not in Boston?
I don't send my kids to public school. We have three kids with three extremely different families. We haven't done any DNA testing, so I don't know if I'm technically the father. I'm wondering, how did these kids come out of the same family? So we've been very blessed and have been able to send them to schools that are, frankly, a better fit for each individual.
Okay, staying on education just for a second, and then I want to get back to your political side of your bio. Marjorie, as you can tell, cares about people. I care about politics. I'm sorry. That's the...
I'm into schools.
I see the painted line.
There is. You know, one of the things that we were talking to Brian McGrory, the editor of The Globe, about this a couple of minutes ago. A couple of weeks ago, we read that the former president of Brandeis is going to take home somewhere in the neighborhood of $8 million for work or in his post-presidency or a sum of severance pay or some whatever it is, $8 million. This morning in the Globe, we read that Brandeis is going to offer buyouts to 13% of their non-faculty staff to close a $6.5 million budget hole. When you read that, $8 million to a former president for his former presidential life and $6.5 million in cuts, which means the staff for these students is cut 13%, what reaction do you have as a business guy and as a candidate for governor?
Well, first, I'd like to know what his batting average was in the World Series because that seems a little high and out of market to me, if you will. I think that there are definitely situations where compensation across a number of fields, this is not just education, has certainly gotten out of control. I'm not familiar with enough of the situation to know how they could fix a problem. I know there are times that you just have to bite the bullet and move on because you're in the wrong kind of contracts, what have you. And it could be a situation where they're just trying to stem the tide. And from here going forward, they're going to do the right thing.
You want to be an independent governor of Massachusetts. We've never had one, correct? We have had an independent governor?
No,
we haven't, right. And so how do you govern as an independent? Now, it is true that 52 or some percent of the voters are unenrolled, and that's obviously by definition more than combined enrolled Democrats and Republicans. It's fine. You get elected because the people are sick of both parties. I assume that's going to be part of your theme. I don't know what your theme is going to be. How do you govern? Maybe there'll be one independent person out of 200, if that.
Well, I think that's definitely an elephant in the room. I think it's a very valid question. Angus King, the two-time governor of Maine, elected as an independent both times. Angus had me to a long dinner in Washington. He's now a U.S. senator. And he said, you know, it is a lot easier to govern as an independent. And it was really the theme of our conversation. He said, when you are in the middle, always trying to make the right decision for the people of the Commonwealth, as opposed to getting pulled back either because of a special interest or because of, you know, you just have obligations to your party if you come up through the party system.
Angus King, I think, is a wonderful model, and obviously there is Jesse Ventura in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he'd be a role model or not. The difference, which I think is dramatic, is Angus King governed with a virtually evenly split legislature, almost half Republicans, almost half Democrats. So a skillful politician, and he clearly has the ability to play one side, you know, that kind of thing. You were going to enter a building where in all likelihood 95%, 92% are of one party gunning for it. I mean, that's the nature of the beast. You're elected by the people, but 92% of the people say he's not one of us. Maybe they voted for him, but he's not one of us. And you know how insular that can be. How do you deal with an all-Democratic Senate and House, which is very different from Angus King's deal?
Well, let's look at the last 8 years where there's been alignment. And yet, I would argue when you look at the kinds of areas like, you know, whether it's pension funds, education, healthcare, energy, you name it, can you tell me of a lot of really bold things that they did and a lot of problems that they fixed? So,
well, Deval Patrick, who sits here once a month, would say in every one of the areas, you don't think he's made significant achievement advances in any of those areas?
I think we have an extraordinary far way to go, and I think there are a lot of opportunities that are missed opportunities.
Why'd you vote for him the second time if he was so unaccomplished the first time?
Well, the first time, let's face it, I mean, he inherited a nightmare. It was very, very difficult for all of us. We run small companies. I get it. It was a firefight for everybody. I think he's a very good man. I think he's got some great ideas, by the way.
What's his best idea?
Well, I think where he's going, for instance, with some alternative energy. As you probably know, we started with that plant down in Quincy, built the largest biodiesel company in North America at the time out of it. That has real legs and is long term. You can't just prop up the industry, though. You have to do it through the best technologies, right? So there's a balance here. But I think that is where the world's going to go.
You know, the health connector in Massachusetts is not doing very well, as I'm sure you know. Mm-hmm. And Obamacare, so-called, has had its struggles. But you've talked about opting out of Obamacare. What would that mean for people in Massachusetts if you win and that's what happens?
Well, again, I believe that given the collective intellect of this Commonwealth and also the market dynamics of this Commonwealth, I would bet on people in Massachusetts being able to take care of the people in Massachusetts better than the federal government figuring out their problems and taking care of the folks of Massachusetts. As you know, in healthcare, it's not a one-size-fits-all in our country. We have very, very different healthcare capabilities throughout the United States. And let's not kid ourselves, we are in a state that has extraordinary healthcare capabilities. Now, are there things that need to be fixed? There's no question about it. Are there technologies that have to be brought to bear that will save tens of millions of dollars? Absolutely.
Go ahead, Marjorie. Go where you want to go. I know where you want to go.
Well, I don't know where I want to go. I did want to say that there are people, though, that don't qualify for, you know, MassHealth or the Health Connector that have some enthusiasm for being able to get a policy through the federal government. And there are a lot of programs like the Kids Up to 26 and, mm-hmm. and you know, if you outspend, and this happens in Massachusetts.
Keep your kid
right
on
now,
your own insurance yes. policy up until you're
And if you have some dread disease yeah. and you've run through all your insurance and you're 45 and you're stuck, I mean, those things are very attractive. So I think opting out, it sounds a little scary.
Well, it doesn't mean that our system can't be fixed or our system can't be improved. We live in a dynamic environment. And
right.
it should be a constant cycle of assessing and reassessing, you know, where you are with anything. This is not just limited to healthcare, by the way. Education is exactly the same. Energy is the same. Even the lowering the bureaucracies within Beacon Hill. You know, this is about creating jobs. And if we do that and we become the economic engine that I know we're capable of. I mean, I meet with entrepreneurs all day long.
Yep.
You know, more than 1,000 companies a year. That's a lot of visibility. It's there.
You know, we're talking to Jeff McCormick, who, again, is an independent candidate for, you know, again, she's taking the high road. I'll go back to the low road for a second. You've assembled an interesting team.
I want
team.
My kids to be covered until they're 26.
We know
I'm
you do. You'll talk healthcare, education. I'll talk whatever. In any case, you've assembled an interesting team. Joe Malone, noted Republican, leaves the Republican Party. He says, because of you, and essentially to support your candidacy. Dan Payne, noted longtime Democratic consultant, ad man, joins with a friend of his, but a Republican, Todd Domke, to both be working on your campaign. The question I know, who do you like more, Todd Domke or Dan Payne? That's quite a kind of tough question. I think you've got to answer, Jeff, if you want to get it. Okay, fine.
Thank you.
Let's get back to politics. Do you vote in local elections?
Sure, I do.
Have you worked with your local state reps and senators and that sort of thing?
You know, I really haven't because...
Do you know who they are, by the way?
Well,
I don't mean that as a joke. Do you know who your state rep and senator is?
You know... Do I know
you
her?
Don't, I mean,
no, our reps and senators. I never work. I never.
So
work
you don't
with
know
any.
Who you're the ones who represent you are,
yeah.
even though you voted.
Well, they.
But anyway, so I guess my sense is one of the things you have to do. The two things I think are going to be tough. Not that you need when you have Domke and Payne, you don't need the likes of me. Is one, everybody's going to probe every single business thing you ever made, and you're going to have the tension. Do I release or not? Are you going to release all this business stuff that all these business guys are?
Yeah, I mean, we all of our businesses are on our website. I mean, it's out there.
But the second thing, and I don't want to say them, because in this case, I generally feel this way, even though there's some exceptions to the rule. When someone hasn't been involved in a particular line of work like politics, why doesn't a Jeff, the generic Jeff McCormick, not and you as well, say, let me start at a different level? I know I'm at the top of the business field, but that's where my area of expertise is.
Sure.
I don't have political expertise, even though, as you said, you think you can transfer a lot of your business skills, which I accept and understand, to government. But does that not concern you? If you were not you, wouldn't you ask the same question to you if you know what I – you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. When you are a small company and you're dealing with guerrillas – I mean, these are Fortune 500 companies. These are guys that can squash you like a bug. And you can get people on the same page and get people to see the win-win and get people to see the common motivations. I don't believe the legislature is a bunch of people that are uncaring people or people that just have their own agenda or you know, that there's no one who is pure of spirit or heart. I just fundamentally don't believe that. I think that in many cases, they need a catalyst, but they also don't, you know, let's face it, they really don't want to let the Republican Party up off the mat. I get it. I understand that. And I'm not out for reelection. I'm not out to try and support a bunch of other candidates. I'm not out to try and start a third party. I'm there to do a job. So they should look at me as, hey, this guy's got a really quirky, interesting gift. Let's use it to their advantage. I don't care. You know, let's just start solving problems and look like the heroes. This is not about the spotlight. It's not about credit. I want to do a job and, frankly, go back to the farm and start working the farm again because that's, as you said, that's what I'm good at.
Yeah, I have one question I'm dying to ask you before we wrap this thing up. You invested
in
the duck tours, right? The duck tours.
Yeah, yeah.
So at what stage were they at when you – I mean, was this – somebody had this – I forget the woman's name that runs
the
company.
Well, actually, so it was Andy Wilson,
okay,
who was the founder. So Andy literally is running around, had talked to VCs. Everyone poo-pooed the idea.
But what would he say? I've got these amphibious trucks.
He didn't have those. He had permits.
He had permits.
He had permits. And this is a business – I believe the total permits were 40 permits, including Army Corps of Engineers. I mean, this is not – uncomplicated stuff.
But his idea was the amphibious trucks.
The idea was definitely the amphibious tours. And it was, I believe we can create something unique, that there's a real need in the market for something that is affordable for families. Because let's face it, sports tickets are expensive in this town.
Ridiculous.
You know?
It's obscene.
I mean, I don't know how you guys feel about that. You know, something that they can do. And can you imagine having your four-year-old gets to drive a 12,000-pound vehicle? Now, in Charles River, of course, they're not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a pretty cool family experience. And it's all about the city of first. It's about Boston at its best. Let's point out every great thing. Now, of course, we didn't envision that we'd have 10 championship parades. Right?
Yeah.
Which is really, really pretty cool.
Weren't we the first to have the duck boats in Boston?
We are the first for the duck boats.
That's what I thought.
But there was a duck boat tour company in the Midwest.
Okay.
Can we go over a couple of issues quickly,
please,
if you can? Casinos, which I am obsessed with. Your obsession level is a little bit lower than mine, Marjorie. I think that's a fair statement to make.
Yes.
But where are you on the whole casino deal?
Well, I'm not a huge fan of casinos overall. It's a very large investment. As you know, in many areas, they've got a lot of unintended consequences. But I understand for certain communities that just tactically, they feel like they need something big. You know, Springfield with MGM coming in. Yeah. Could they build around that if they got that one done? And I do get it. At the end of the day, though, I think the people absolutely positively should have a vote on what goes on in their backyard.
But the reason I ask, beyond the fact that I am obsessed with the topic, is I think I've read elsewhere, I may be wrong, that you said that should the Supreme Judicial Court approve the question for the ballot in 2014, that you'd vote to repeal the casino law. Is that true?
Just as a personal voter. What I would do is I would vote to repeal it because I know there are other, I mean, I know specific projects that are better.
I mean, so, for those communities
for other communities.
How about minimum wage? I mean, the legislature's contemplating it. The theory is they're going to get it done. But if they don't get it done, that's not. Where are you on the minimum wage hike as proposed by, I guess, the Senate is the bill that's currently.
Well, again, not wanting to hurt small businesses. And this is very important because, of course, they employ a lot of minimum wage employees. I think what this Speaker DeLeo did was very, very smart, recognizing small businesses and the effects on them, and then trying to tie it to a decrease in unemployment insurance, which the balance of those two is wise. So you're not hurting small businesses, but you're targeting. I mean, you want people who are working hard for their families to bring home a living wage. I mean, this, and at the end of the day, we have got to build this on the middle class. Because that really is what supports everything else.
But if it were a straight line vote and on raising the minimum wage, not tied to the reforms that the speaker is advocating, you would or wouldn't support that?
I would rather either target the families we're targeting as opposed to a blanket over everyone getting minimum wage. I got minimum wage twice in my life. Both times I got it, frankly.
What were you doing?
I was bagging groceries at one time in my life. Another time I was a file clerk, you know. But I wasn't a primary, you know, breadwinner in the family. And when the Democrats actually studied this 20-some years ago, they realized 85% of who they were targeting, they weren't hitting those people. It was the 15% that they were targeting, but they were trying to throw a big solution over a problem instead of targeting the 15% they were really
trying
to
support. But I interrupted
you.
My apologies, Jeff. You were about to say, but if given my druthers or some such thing about when I asked you if there was a straight vote on a minimum wage, if you were governor, would you sign it? If you're
I'm
a voter, would you? No, it was my fault, not yours. Would you vote for it on the ballot? What was your answer to that question? If it was a straight up.
So my answer, if it's just a thumbs up and thumbs down, I would have to say that if someone can point out and say, you know what, this is really targeting enough of the families, I would be thumbs up on it. If you say it's only 10 or 15% of the people that you're really going after, I'd say we need something specifically for that group of families.
Are we done? Are
no,
we doing cigarettes?
We don't. We have
another
minute.
Oh, I was confused. I thought we were supposed to be talking about cigarettes, but we're not.
We started with marijuana.
We were going to talk about cigarettes, so I was confused. I didn't know that. I kept looking at
you. Well, I got excited about this, so I'm sorry.
But you know, this was one of the things we were going to talk about in cigarettes, this huge tax on cigarettes, and CVS is going to stop selling them, and they're having these ads for teens. But one of the points that actually Tom Keene, Globe columnist, brought up, and I thought it was a great point, we are taxing cigarettes so high in Massachusetts that statewide, 16% of the cigarettes, and in Boston, 40% of the cigarettes are smuggled cigarettes because we've created this black market. What do you think about that? I mean, that's a fascinating point. We're losing this revenue. We're making a lot in the taxes, but we're starting to lose more and more because we've taxed them to the point where people are going illegally to get cigarettes elsewhere. Oh, we're out of time.
No, we're not out of time. We have a minute. Don't we have a minute? I think we have a minute.
We
have 30 seconds.
Okay.
My apologies.
Okay. Well, the quick one is, well, again, on cigarettes, you've got to analyze things. And this is where the feedback loops, because there is a certain point that there's diminishing returns.
Yeah.
That's the way tax policy works just in general. We're driving businesses out of this commonwealth because people don't want to grow here because of the whole tax structure. I know for sure there are people who've left the commonwealth. They go to places like Florida, like Texas, before they take their capital gains because of tax policy.
Now
but Jim Brody would raise the taxes even higher. But we do have to.
I'm
we
not
have
running
to go.
Though, am I? He's
no, you're
running.
Not. No, you're
Jeff
not. Not yet, anyway.
You. What's your website, quickly?
It's jmacforgov.com. www.duck.org.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you for investing in the Duck Tours. We all love them. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browning.
Thanks for listening. Tune in tomorrow.